This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Being a woman in politics can be tough, even on TV.
So you could say, as a woman, I believe
No. I can't identify myself as a woman. People can't know that. Men hate that. And women hate that, which I believe is most women. Don't you agree with that,
yes,
Amy?
And ma'am.
That was Julia Louis-Dreyfus as Vice President Selina Meyer in the HBO political satire Veep. Of course, that's not the attitude we see during what many have called the Year of the Woman. First-term congresswomen have been dominating national politics. This wave came after Hillary Clinton's failed run for the presidency back in 2016. Right now, Senators Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Elizabeth Warren, alongside Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, are leading the Democratic pack for 2020. These progressive candidates are capitalizing on what seems like an unprecedented level of engagement with politics. And what about Republican women? Just over a tenth of the women in Congress are Republicans. What are women facing at the national level? We've seen nastiness in politics, but have things changed for women candidates? And how can we make it better? You've shared a lot of your ideas. Here is some of what you left in our inbox.
This is Mary from Rochester. I'm responding to your call for women getting involved in politics. I was an activist, but I never saw myself as being involved in politics. I voted, but didn't think it mattered. And when Bernie Sanders started coming on the scene, I was really inspired, and I saw that my place is being a part of the process. So I ended up organizing the local campaign locally along with some other folks and getting involved in the Democratic Party. And I responded to his call that if I wanted social change, I should run for office. But only after several times of people telling me that. And that's something that women suffer from, is that they need to be told many, many times that they should run in order for them to see themselves in that place. So I did. I ran for city council in Rochester, New York, and I came just under the bar, and I surprised everyone in the political establishment at how well I did and the team that I built and how much money that I raised.
I'm Stephanie Garcia Richard from Santa Fe, New Mexico, and last November I became the first woman elected to the position of land commissioner in our state with oversight of 9 million acres of land, the second most powerful executive in New Mexico. And I believe that something has shifted for women running for office. I think our mentality about running for office has changed. I had heard before that women have to be asked 7 times to run for office before they'll consider it, when men only have to be asked once. I know there are still questions about our qualifications as women electeds. And while those days are far from gone, women are now more cognizant than ever that we deserve to run and be elected. We're more than half the population, and we deserve to be at every table in every building where laws and decisions are being made. And that shift can't be reversed.
Thank you both for sharing your thoughts with us. Joining us in studio is Sabrina Schaefer, a board member at Right Now Women. The organization helps elect women on the political right. She also chairs the leadership circle at the Independent Women's Forum. Sabrina, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joining us from San Francisco is Amanda Renteria, the former national political director for Hillary for America. Amanda currently serves as the board chair at Emerge America, a nonprofit helping Democratic women win office. And she is also the first Latina chief of staff in the U.S. Senate. Amanda, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
And joining us from Houston, Texas is Michelle Hebel, a professor of psychological sciences and management at Rice University. Her work includes a forensic analysis of the forces at play in the 2016 election. Professor Hebel, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Now, before the 2018 election, Congress was 20% women. Now it's 24%. Previously, 107 seats were held by women. Now it's 126, a record number of women sworn into office. Amanda Renteria, let me start with you. Is it easier to run for office as a woman now than, say, 10 years ago?
I think so. Certainly, what we saw across 2018, and it's not just that women are running, but it's that women are banding together to lift each other up. And I think we saw that Inauguration Day after President Trump came into office. We saw that happen, and really that energy has continued throughout. And a lot of people wondered whether we would see that to fruition in the 2018 election cycle, and we certainly did. And I think just having that sisterhood around you makes a huge difference. And in your two callers, one of them is actually an Emerge alum, and she was part of this sisterhood that really helped push us, push women forward to run and to win.
Sabrina Schaefer, same question. Is it easier for women to run for office now than, say, 10 years ago?
I certainly think it is. I think that we've seen a lot of women on both sides of the aisle who have taken that opportunity. And I think we've seen a lot of success stories. I think that obviously sexism is always going to be part of our political culture. I hope not forever. But right now, I think there is still some vestiges of that. But I think it's far less. I think we've seen in the research that voters, the media, they're taking gender in some respects less seriously, which is a good thing.
Professor Hebel, kind of the same question, although I wonder if you might help us define the term. I think, as I ask it, I think that saying, is it easier, is a little broad. What are we looking at, Professor, when we look at the factors that affect women running for office? What does it mean to be easier?
Well, I think there's a couple things I think of immediately. One is just the level of sexism and awareness that has come into the fore in the last couple of years with the Me Too movement. I think people, women particularly, have gotten to a situation where they are utterly frustrated. And they say, you know what, the time is now. The time is now for me to try to actually get engaged and to stop watching this nonsense from the sidelines. So I think in that way, it's easier because people feel called. Women feel called more than ever. I think overt sexism and more subtle types of sexism are more visible. And I think people really are ready for a change.
Amanda, what have you seen happening in the last few years? It seems like this conversation kicked up very strongly, not surprisingly, with Hillary Clinton's candidacy. But even thereafter, from 2016 to the midterms, it felt, Amanda, like the issue of women running for office just got hotter and hotter and hotter all the way up to the midterm elections.
That's right. And there's a couple of things that have really shaped this. Number one is the sincere motivation that a lot of these women and why they're running, right? So there was just a recent study about men used to look at politics as a career path, whereas women, it wasn't something they thought about, just as you started off the show with about, you know, callers saying, I didn't imagine myself. Well, now people are imagining themselves and they're coming at it from a very personal, passionate standpoint of why they're running. And we saw that across the board. We also saw people running as who they were. I think in the past, it used to be women had to wear shoulder pads, right? And it had to look a little bit more male dominated. What you saw across the across the country is women running exactly as who they were. And that in and itself is a welcoming process to say, women, we want you exactly as you are. And then an ecosystem was built. I mean, you're hearing on this show, we have, you know, Republican women also building groups to help women and to build that ecosystem where women are playing a role in the entire, not just running, but ensuring that they're volunteers, they're donors, they're activists, they're researchers all across the board. And that is really what has made it different in this last election cycle and what I think will lay the groundwork for the future as well.
Yeah, Sabrina Schaefer, talk a little bit more about that ecosystem as it relates to conservative women and Republican women.
Sure. Well, first, I would say that, you know, in some respects, people say, well, yes, there was a surge this year and it was a response to Donald Trump on one hand, and perhaps this idea that Hillary Clinton should have won the presidency. And so there was this sort of big movement, so it was groundswell. At the same time, I would say that Democrats, to their credit, have invested for years and years, cycle after cycle, into research, into preparing, into recruitment. And I think all of that has sort of there was sort of like a perfect storm where there for Democrats, there was this opportunity now to take advantage of all of that work that had been done. And I think for Republicans and for anyone sort of right of center who wants to see more women who believe in a sort of a limited government, they have to realize that they're so far behind that there is a lot of work to be done, because even with all of the work that Democrats have been doing for decades, they're still not at parity, right? So for Republicans to begin to catch up, they have to start convincing donors and the party apparatus and policymakers that this is really important toward affecting policy change down the road.
Do you get the sense, Sabrina, that the GOP is on that page now, that they consider it a priority and they're moving on it?
I think that there are a lot of outside groups that see this as very important. I think there's groups like Winning for Women and Right Now and VPAC and EPAC. I think all of these groups recognize the importance of this. I do think that there's going to be there's going to need to be sort of a heavier lift when it comes to donors and the party because they simply haven't taken gender seriously for so long.
Maria wrote on our Facebook page, the candidate gets attacked for being too emotional or not emotional enough, what she wears, how attractive she is, etc. You know, really pointless qualities that have no bearing on her qualifications for the position. We should dig into this when we continue our conversation with Sabrina Schaefer of Right Now Women and the Independent Women's Forum, Amanda Renteria of Emerge America and formerly of Hillary for America, and Rice University Professor Michelle Hebel. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
I feel pretty.
When do we feel pretty?
Oh, so pretty.
Why do we feel pretty? And who gets to decide what pretty is? We'll answer our listeners' questions all about beauty this week on the Code Switch podcast.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing women in national politics, what's been changing over the last few years, and where is change still needed? Professor Hebel, let's talk a little bit about some of your research. You study discrimination against women in leadership roles, and you did an assessment of the 2016 election. And if I'm understanding your results correctly, the assessment basically laid out that America was not ready for a female president. What made you come to that conclusion?
Well, what makes me come to that conclusion is just overt sexism and subtle sexism and the depths of it. So if you look at that election, there's simply no way based on record that Hillary should have lost. So why did she lose? Well, you can say it may have been the way she held her campaign, but what it comes down to, if you look at the theories and you look at the data that shows across meta-analyses, many, many hundreds of studies, is there is a belief that women's place is not in leadership roles. And we have the stereotypes, we see it over and over again in series of studies from looking at heads of tables. So you have people seated around a table. And if it's a man seated at the head of the table, people assume he's a leader. If it's a woman seated at the head of the table, they look to a man on the side to lead. If you look at men and women in leadership positions and you look at the feedback that they get, both men and women are nodded to and looked at with negativity, because if you think about leaders and they're saying things, you have a look of, oh, I wonder what they're saying. That's interesting. There's no difference there. But what you see a difference on is the positivity that they get. Men are given much more positive smiles, affirmations than women are. So you see it at the nonverbal level a lot. And you have a lot of people saying, oh, yeah, that was sexist. That was sexist. And people say, well, you know, people are just crying sexism. But study after study shows there are these microaggressions. There are these subtle schemas that people have. And added to that, I think we've seen a real rise in overt types of sexism coming back. So if we look at the bumper stickers that say things like women's place is in the home, women don't belong at the head, you know, these kind of really negative, overt types of discrimination are on the rise as well. So I think until we tackle fully the overt and subtle discrimination, it's going to be hard for women to reach those top places.
Amanda Renteria, can you talk about some of the specifics that you encountered working with Hillary Clinton as, you know, the policy director for her 2016 run? Were there specific examples of this kind of sexism that you can recall that had a direct bearing on the outcome of the election? Anything you can put your finger on?
Sure. I mean, across the board, it's always a harder bar to reach the credibility line, the likable line. And in fact, if you're working on being credible, a lot of folks will view that as not likable for women. And so striking that right balance has always been difficult, especially as media and others really judge women. But I do want to say this. And I actually believe women can absolutely win a presidency. And this is why. I think this often gets lost. But 2016, it was proven for the first time in American history, 3 million more Americans voted for a woman over a man. Yes, the Electoral College was dismissed, but at the end of the day, 3 million more said a woman can be president over a man. The second piece, and this is something that's always been debated, is whether or not a woman can be seen as qualified, tough enough, etc., to be commander in chief. And there was no question that there was a woman who fit that mold. And I believe that that piece will, we're not going back on that because now we have a real image of what that looks like. Doesn't mean that the path is hard still for women, women today. Absolutely. It is a little bit harder. But the reality is we now have an actual vision of it is possible. And I think that piece of it for me, I'm absolutely convinced we can do this. But they'll still face, you know, a lot of these questions about what did you wear? Yeah. Is it too emotional, right?
Sabrina, I wonder also if part of the impact was with Donald Trump's rhetoric on the campaign trail. I mean, he said some abominable things about women in the primaries and in the general election. And I mean, just damnable things that most of us wouldn't put up with someone saying about our mothers or our wives or our sisters. But it unleashed something in the body politic that got a reaction, that was there and kind of legitimized these points of view that, you know, maybe voters don't like to talk about, but that are still there.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think that there were a lot of different variables that went into the 2016 election. We can't ignore sort of this rise of populism on both the right and the left that sort of took the country by surprise in many ways. I certainly think that there are, as I said, vestiges of sexism. I think, you know, I think back to when Michelle Bachmann was running a number of years back now, and I remember there was a whole hoopla when she left the stage during one of the debates, and all the men were standing there during the commercial break, and it turned out she had, you know, a little makeup emergency. It was an eyelash was involved. And I remember thinking, gosh, it's so unfair. You're going out in front of millions of Americans. Of course, you're going to want to look your best. And it is harder. And I remember thinking this year with Mia Love, I mean, she was criticized for, you know, people did say, you know, you shouldn't be running. You're a mother. And I thought, gosh, we're still having this conversation. But at the same time, I do worry that this narrative, and I do think the Clinton campaign had this, that women are sort of swimming upstream against the sexist current is worrisome. It's damaging. It feels antiquated to a lot of women who are looking around saying, well, women are succeeding in so many, you know, areas of life. And so I'm not sure that that's the strategy that women on either side of the aisle want to take moving forward. Rather, I would suggest, and I think the research suggests this too, that when instances of sexism happen, a candidate must call them out. And when they do, it seems to shut it down.
Well, I think it's also worth noting, Amanda, that even the discussion about the highest, hardest glass ceiling that Hillary Clinton said, that even seemed to turn some voters off as a form of identity politics. Josh wrote on our Facebook page, "Identity politics will ruin the party. Voting for someone based on their gender, race, or sexual preference is not the way our leaders should be chosen." Mild amendment to Josh's Facebook post, the term is sexual orientation rather than sexual preference, but I know what she meant. And I understand Josh's point, Amanda. I mean, this idea of voting for Hillary Clinton because, well, it's about time that a woman became president, I think turns some voters off.
Yeah, I mean, I believe that when you run as your whole person. And there's certainly, she couldn't deny that she was a woman, right? And I think you're seeing more and more when women run, yes, it's a part of who they are, and it's an important piece of their perspective. But, you know, when you look at 2018, I didn't see a lot of narratives where women were saying, vote for me because I'm a woman. And Hillary didn't do that either. It's the stark reality when you're breaking any glass ceiling, whether it's a woman of color, people will talk about that. And there's a way that the campaign needs to embrace that and yet not make it the sole item that someone's running for. And I think 2018 really did throw that notion out the window because we saw so many people run on their background, on their passion, on their different stories. And so I think we're certainly beyond that conversation today. And I don't imagine, I mean, even the women that are out there, none of them are running saying, because I'm a woman. And I think as an electorate and voters aren't looking at it and saying, okay, there's now just one woman, right? There's now different people on the platform, at least in the Democratic Party.
With regards to the way one presents oneself, Professor Hebel, I'd love to get your take on that, because we've been seeing a new kind of authenticity, or at least, you know, the openness among candidates. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is the queen of all Instagram, for sure, and it has just kind of endeared her to a lot of people. Even Senator Kamala Harris from California, who's running for president, recently released a mixtape on her Twitter feed with her favorite songs, showing a bit of her personality. Here's a little clip of that.
One Nation Under a Groove by Funkadelic. One Nation Under a Groove, getting down just for the funk of it. Can I get it on the... Wow!
Kamala Harris having a little fun with some Funkadelic. I can't blame her for a musical choice. I love that song too. But Professor Hebel, what's your take on how women on the national political scene are presenting themselves differently, particularly trying to be more authentic?
I think that's exactly what we need, which is authenticity. I think our politics have a serious, we have trust issues with politicians. I think we've never felt so low as a country about our political state. And when you see somebody being so authentic, when you see a woman laughing and being so likable and being so incredibly competent, that is what they're going to need to do. And they can try to take the same routes, the sort of more traditional routes, but what we find with women is the traditional routes don't always work. So I really applaud the way that these women are showing their authenticity, and I think that is the way to the White House.
Do you think, Professor, that women are under greater pressure, less pressure, the same pressure as men to present a kind of authentic image? I mean, there's always been this stereotype of, you know, the person you could have a beer with. They joked about it in the lyrics of Hamilton. Like, it's one of these things where we're supposed to see you shaking hands and hanging out with the family, and we had shots of Barack Obama playing basketball. Like, is that different for women, or is it just kind of the way politics is?
I mean, I think men have their own struggles, and one of their struggles is that they're defined mostly by their careers, whereas women are defined sometimes by their careers and sometimes by their personalities much more than men are. And so I think we get into a dimension of something that people call lack of fit. The researchers call this communal agency differentiation. So communal is how kind you are, how sensitive you are, and the agency is the leadership. And I think for women it is harder because they have to balance the leadership. If they're not seen as leaders, if they're not seen as competent, they're not going to make it. So they have to be seen as competent. But then they also have to balance this delicate communal aspect. So if they're too communal, if they're too caring, if they're too nice, they're seen as pushovers. And if they're not nice enough, then they're seen as problematic. So I do think this authenticity really drives the communal perceptions in the correct way.
Sabrina, to carry that a little forward, I think if women are seen as too competent or too strong a leader or too take charge, they can be viewed as bossy, which I think, if a lot of men were honest, is a euphemism for another B word that's inappropriate to say about women who you feel threatened by.
Right. And certainly sometimes that is the case. Mm-hmm. You know, I think what some of this conversation comes down to is that politics is personal. And this is where I think Republicans and sort of the center-right community can, you should sort of really kind of pay attention, because our gender doesn't define, you know, everything about us, right? It doesn't determine how I think about ideas, but it is a big part of who I am, right? I'm a wife, I'm a mother, I'm a working mother. These are things that influence the way I think about education or healthcare or the environment, paid leave. And so I think we have to be careful not to be scared of embracing who we are. Because again, politics is personal. When a lawmaker gets up there or a candidate, they're talking to a specific audience. And women have that advantage that they can talk to other women in a way that men simply can't. That's not a bad thing. It doesn't make men bad. It doesn't make women better. It makes them different. And it means that they have something else to offer, and that we shouldn't run away from it. And so again, it all comes back to that idea that politics is personal.
Amanda, let me ask you about running as a woman of color or being a woman of color in politics. Here is a clip from Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts. Listen.
When a woman of color talks about running for higher office or public office at all, folks don't just talk about a glass ceiling. Yes, we face many of the same trials our sisters and women of all colors face when answering the call to serve. But the well-intended conversations that occur when a woman of color seeks public office take on a texture all their own. Can a congresswoman wear her hair in braids, rock a black leather jacket, wait a minute, and a bold red lip? When it comes to women of color candidates, folks don't just talk about a glass ceiling. What they describe is a concrete one.
That's Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, a Democrat representing a district in and around Boston, Massachusetts. Amanda, what about that, this idea of a concrete ceiling rather than a glass ceiling for women of color, with all these additional facets involved in the way people perceive them?
That's right. The layers. I can't tell you when I ran for Congress in the Central Valley, and I remember consultants saying,
I'm sorry, the Central Valley of California.
Central Valley of California.
Gotcha, gotcha.
And I show up and someone said, you know, your earrings are a little too long and your lipstick's a little too red, right? And I said, man, if my mom heard that right now, she she would look at me and say, that's who you are, right? That's what people want. And by the way, I was running in a district that was 70% Latino. And those are the kinds of moments that I look back on that, God, I am so glad they are beginning to change. And you're seeing women of color like Ayanna Pressley, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, really pushing that mold, showing up with the lipstick. I mean, I will never forget, and I got teary-eyed as I watched the House of Representatives and seeing the sea on the Democratic side of women dressed in their own colors, just the vibrancy of it and the beauty of what they were bringing. But I got to tell you, as a woman of color, someone who's ran, someone who's been in this space, you are fighting every single step of the way, not just on gender, but on race and your culture, and saying, no, my culture does matter. It is who I am.
I want to talk a little bit more about the Republican side when we continue our conversation. Stay close.
Hey, it's Ophira Eisenberg from Ask Me Another. If you're craving nerdy trivia or celebrity interviews, we've got you covered. With house musician Jonathan Colton and the sharpest contestants in public radio, don't miss NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
Back now to our conversation with Professor Mickey Hebel of Rice University, Sabrina Schaefer of Right Now Women and the Independent Women's Forum, and Amanda Renteria of Emerge America and formerly of Hillary for America. Sabrina Schaefer, let me talk to you about women on the political right. Here's a clip of Carly Fiorina and her response to some controversial comments Donald Trump made about her appearance back in 2016 during the presidential campaigns.
It's still different for women. It's only a woman whose appearance would be talked about while running for president, never a man. And I think that's what women understand. That's why women understood what Donald Trump said about my face in the first place and also what he said about my face in the second place. The point is, women are half this nation. Women are half the potential of this nation. But somehow, we still spend a lot of time talking about women's appearance instead of their qualifications.
That was Carly Fiorina reacting to comments that Donald Trump made about her appearance during the 2016 presidential campaign. How much of this push to improve the way women are treated in politics, Sabrina, has to do with Donald Trump? And how much of it is other stuff? It's been building for a while. It seems like the phenomenon of candidate, now President Trump, has kind of catalyzed it, but it didn't begin and end with him. He came from somewhere.
Right. Not at all. I mean, look, I think that this president says things that is for a whole nother show, right? And I think Carly is correct to push back on this. I think she was a wonderful candidate. But it actually takes us to one of the other issues beyond sort of the sexism question that's keeping more women from running for office. And there was a really interesting study out of the University of Pittsburgh a couple of years back which showed that it's not women's, you know, sort of differences in ability or their differences in confidence levels with men. What really seems to keep women out of politics is the noisiness of the modern campaign and this idea that they won't be able to get their point across. They won't be able to have a real conversation about the policies that matter. And I think that's what Carly was sort of getting at there, that women who want to get involved with politics want to have a conversation about the issues that matter. And unfortunately, and it is exacerbated by our 24-hour news cycle and social media, that they often feel like they can't. And so that is something that I think we can all work on, that we want to bring the conversation back to education or paid leave or workplace regulations or foreign policy or whatever it is that makes, you know, is important at the moment, but trying to make the campaign less noisy.
Thad wrote on our Facebook page, please have the panelists address the 51% of white women who voted for Donald Trump after the Access Hollywood tape leaked and how women candidates will overcome that phenomenon in the future.
Yes. Well, look, I think that partisanship is it's very strong. We know that sort of our commitment to our party identification is stronger than religious identification. It can be very difficult for people to think about voting for someone in another party. It could take multiple election cycles for them to do so. And so I think we need to keep that in mind. This was a particularly divisive election. So I'm not sure I can give an exact answer for why people did that. But I think that for a lot of Republicans, ultimately, they were willing to sort of hold their nose about things they didn't like about the candidate at the time, President Trump now, because they were hopeful that they would get market-based policies that they've been working toward for a long time. And people can have different opinions on whether that whether that was the right thing for people to do or not. But I think they looked at Hillary Clinton and they saw more big government in healthcare and more big government in the workplace and in the environment and energy. And they thought, no, we don't want that. And so, you know, we don't like this man or we don't like the way he behaves, but we're willing to go along with it.
Let's ask the three of you about some of the things that need to happen going forward. Professor Hebel, based on your research, what are some of the things that you would encourage all kinds of female candidates to keep in mind?
Well, I think they should be authentic, but I think in the back of their minds, they also have to make sure that they're demonstrating competence and that they're also demonstrating this very good balance between being caring, but not being too caring, but not being not caring enough. I think that, as the other invitees have said, it is not the case that they're going to get anywhere just because they're a woman. So I think, again, having grit, being able to weed their way through what is probably going to be another toxic cycle is going to be important. And I think just, you know, what I hope is that whoever is elected in the next cycle makes it a better world for both genders.
Sabrina, where do you see the impetus on the right in terms of encouraging this kind of advocacy? Is it still a minority of the political right that's pushing for this, or is the tide beginning to turn?
I think the tide is beginning to turn. You know, I was thinking about sort of an activist I know in Virginia who I would never think to talk about gender as something, but I think a lot of people are starting to look at the math, frankly. And if you're a real partisan, Republican partisan, they ought to be looking at the math, right? I mean, 13 female Democrats unseated male Republicans in 2018. That was a third of the seats. So if Republicans have an interest in winning, then they ought to be thinking about women. I think the issue goes well beyond math, but from a partisan perspective. And the other thing I would just add is that there's not a perfect time to run. So to the mom's running point, I think one of the things that I hope people are thinking about is that, you know, you might have young children at home right now and can't conceive of leaving them each night and early in the mornings and things like that. But I always think of someone like Nancy Pelosi. This can be something that you think about now and you don't do for 10 years. And I think there's a lot of good bipartisan groups. There's groups like Running Start, which are helping sort of create a pipeline of leaders on both sides of the aisle so that one day when it's the right time and you're in the right district, you might say, hey, you know what? I have the skills. I've thought about this. I'm ready to do it.
Sabrina Schaefer, a member of the board of directors at Right Now Women and chair of the leadership circle at the Independent Women's Forum. Sabrina, we appreciate your time. Thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Amanda Renteria, former national political director for Hillary for America and currently the chair at Emerge America. Amanda, thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
And Michelle Hebel, the Martha and Henry Malcolm Lovett Professor of Psychological Sciences and Management at Rice University in Houston. Thanks, Professor.
Thank you.
This conversation was produced by Bianca Martin and edited by Miranda Fulmore. You can learn more about them and the rest of our team online at the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.